All right, I think we have started already, and of all the lessons that I've taught so far, this is probably the most gut-wrenching of them all because it deals with violence and war during this time. And you're torn between you wanting, you're a Zionist, you want Israel to be in the land, and you see the oppositions that opposition they face. And they meet opposition with violence, and you have a question, is this the way to do this? So you're kind of torn with that, and you'll see that in our lesson today, that Israel gets criticized for its violence, and they probably can be criticized for the violence, but they're also backed into a corner with no escape. And when that happens to a wild animal, he comes out ferociously attacking the object of his assault. So I sort of decided that I probably can't make any real moral judgment about the violence that Israel, I mean, I can't on a case-by-case basis because I wasn't there. And they were abandoned. And so what are they going to do? So anyway, that's kind of the lesson I call the nation at war. And it is a nation that began to be officially at war on May 15, 1948, and it continues to be in a state of war today. All that Israel has ever gotten so far are armistices. There's been truces, but the ceasefires, but the other side has never stepped up and say, well, let's settle this, because their condition of settlement is Israel doesn't exist there. And that's a condition, like you have to take yourself out of the equation in order for there to be peace. That's pretty hard to do. I mean, if you were in such a spot, says, we'll have peace, but I've got to kill you first. Probably not something you want to take on seriously. So that's really where Israel is, and Israel now has been in the land since 1948. That gets us 68 years, which is quite a long time. And it is, I've been there a number of times, it is remarkable. That oasis in the desert, it is absolutely remarkable. It is a beautiful, beautiful place with a lot of work to make it that. It's in the desert. They have to work at it very hard, but they love the land. And they work at it in ways like as if it is their land. So it's really a beautiful place. It's have a chance to go do that sometime. I'm going back, and if I could get my energy up in next year or so. We're ready to go, I think. You know, we talk about, if we can summarize the movement here, we have the three streams, the Christian stream and the Jewish stream and the Gentile stream. We've been pretty much into the Gentile stream for a while now, and they all contribute to the nation of Israel. And these three streams have notables in them. I say the Christian stream is probably don't have individuals as such, but more like movements. Christianity doesn't work well with a head. We find that with the Pope, so it doesn't work well with a head. So it works better with there is no head. We all function separately with our head, Jesus Christ, who's head of the church. So I think it's why there is no head in the Christian movement, but we do have movements like the Restorationism and the Futurism, which is what we are into in our particular theology, which I think is biblical. We have Jewish personalities, listed them there. I'm not going to go through that again. We have the Gentile personalities, and I sort of am building my list as I go along. And last week I had Joseph Stalin, the USSR, sort of as an adjunct, and I pushed him up to a first-class person. I think the contribution that Russia made with Israel, which is part of what that article we're talking about, points out, which I pointed out to you last week, but this guy does a more fuller job with it. It's very, very significant that I think Russia had not as much to do with it, Russia's contribution was not like Truman's, but it was significant in a sense. We could say that without Russia, they couldn't have become a state, and I'll go through that some with you tonight. So those are the personalities then on the politicians or the Gentile side of it. Now, I always like to give you a little bit of a summary of what we are. You never know who might walk in and have no idea what we're doing. So in a few sentences, trying to get everybody up to speed. We're talking about modern day Zionism, started in 1897 with Theodor Herzl. Moving into the 20th century, early part of the century, we have a letter to Rothschild, Lord Rothschild, a Jewish representative, dated November 2, 1917, written by Lord Balfour under the direction of the Prime Minister David Lloyd George, writes that Britain will liberate the Levant in World War I. They're in the process of doing that, and intends to provide a homeland for the Jews. This is the British government telling the Jewish people. The provision of this letter, provisions were adopted by the Allied nations after World War I. The victorious nations owned by international law the right to make land distributions. Very important point. It was appropriate that England would receive the Allies' mandate, called the British Mandate, to establish a home for the Jews, and was not duty-bound to establish an Arab state. No obligation at all. But there was one for a Jewish state. The British General Allenby had liberated the land from the Turkish rule by the end of World War I, somewhere by 1918, November, October, somewhere in there, it was finished, completed. Then they had the armistice. Well, this Arab nationalism does not exist. In fact, it really doesn't exist today. There's talk like it does, but if there's talk, there's no action. You know, the Arabs tend to work under leaderships like a caliph or a king or a sheikh. This whole idea that there's a national country that has elected offices and, you know, services to the people, whether it's roads, education, airports, something doesn't really has not occurred to them. They have not lived that way. You know, we have said before that back in 83, that was not that long ago, you could go to the Middle East and Israel and see the Arabs living exactly in the way the Abraham did. So that's 4,000 years later. They hadn't moved their advancement an inch, except some of them did have TVs on the top of their tents, and they had Mercedes sitting in the driveway. So there was one difference. And they had a lot of camels, which were made them wealthy. It is true that there are some Arabs in the land we're talking about here, in the Levant, but they never organized into a nation, nor was there any interest. Nor was there any interest in a nation, because they were wandering, largely wandering Bedouins, who by the practice never owned property or wanted to own property, because that would mean they'd have to settle in a spot permanently, not interested in that. And then when the government brought water to them, then they all of a sudden settled down because they didn't need to move anymore. Therefore, the land, we call it the Levant, that whole eastern Mediterranean coast is Levant, Syria sometimes called, was not Arab land. You're thinking it's Arab land, aren't you? But it's not. It was Turkish land. Are Turks Arabs? Turks are Turks. They're Turks. All right. So, therefore, the land of Levant was not Arab land, but Turkish since 1299 after the Crusades. Now, since the Arab nations in the Middle East were aligned with the losing side in World War I, Germany and so forth, all of the territory was recast as new nations, with new heads who served until permanent leaders could be elected. And here we have a picture of how that ended up being. We had French were involved in the northern part of Syria, Lebanon. We have the British, which is now Iraq. And we have what was the British mandate for the Jews. Then up here, after a little bit of war, Turkey ended up getting back some of the land, and the nations agreed to that. Rather than continue to fight them and divide this up into a Holstein cow, they let it go as one nation for the Turks, for Turkey, and that's how it is still today. Although, you know, sometimes you look at the Kurds on the east side, you wonder why they didn't divide it up a little more, because they fight each other all the time. So the Allied nations did allow smaller Turkey to continue. They also provided the Arab with a new Syria here. It's actually French. Started out by Faisal. Then, you know, France and Britain had this fight over this piece of land, and Allenby wanted it for England, but, you know, they had the secret agreement, the Pico secret agreement, so French actually gets it. And so when Faisal gets on the throne, it was not very long that French come along and throw him off. But he did get it for a while, a couple of months. So then we have Iraq is formed as part of the British mandate. And the Ibn Saud down here in Saudi Arabia, they still have that land. They didn't reassign that. So the British were also given the mandate to provide a Jewish land out of the Ottoman Empire. Borders were set by the nations, not the United Nations. This would be set by the Allied Nations and ratified by the League of Nations. Now, diplomatic duplicity, that's the problem today with our lesson. For the British, the task of administering the mandate becomes troublesome soon as it is adopted in 1920 after the San Remo Conference. Right away, they have riots in Jaffa. Our studies have shown that the conflict is not about what was intended by the international community. That's really not an issue. But that it was not accepted by the Arabs, and these Arabs really have no legal standing. Change in leadership in England, who had less interest in administering the mandate, then they entered into a period of diplomatic duplicity, eventually denying all Jewish immigration and land ownership, but at the same time not restricting neither of these to the Arab immigrants. So it's almost like the coin got totally flipped over. It was for the Jews, and when we're all done, at the end of our lesson, we'll find that the Jews are out and the Arabs are in. And the Arabs never had a promise to be in. But that's the duplicity aspect of it. Now, international pressure on the West, the fear of, especially on England, the international pressure, the fear of disgrace and fear of the loss of the Suez Canal and the territories associated with Egypt kept the British in their responsibility. It wouldn't have been for the Suez Canal, Egypt with the Suez Canal. If they wouldn't have had that concern, they would have got out right away. But they knew when they'd get out, guess who would move into this vacuum, or who worried that would move into this vacuum, be Russia. Big bear. So with the threat of World War I in 1939, the second war now, threat of World War I, it should be two in 1939, the British armies are stretched, or potentially stretched, by peacekeeping duties in the Levant, or they are worried that they're going to have troops everywhere because Hitler's advancing now into Poland. They issue a white paper, which is the second white paper, that ends Jewish expansion without Arab consent. Well, the effect was that a homeland for the Jews was never to be under that condition. It's over. The Jews knew it. The Arabs had regained their hopes by it. And the British began to look for a way out. And we announced that on February 14, 1947, sometime later. But they were looking to get out. And the reason to get out earlier, because the Suez Canal kept them there. Interest in it, because that's a passage to the east. The white paper marks a dramatic shift in the mandate, as we said. The policy change is that Britain, or British, will give in to the Arab demands and give Zionism only perfunctory support. They give in to the Arab demands who have no standing, and ignore basically the Jewish people for whom they're supposed to serve. Ever since the mandate was given, the British have a hard time keeping the peace. To keep the peace, they only disarmed the Jews. That's almost so backwards. The people that you disarm are the ones that can keep the peace, and the ones that are going to destroy the peace are the ones that keep the arms. Kind of like, a little bit like our gun laws that by some today say you take the guns away from the peaceful people and give them to the... You can't take away from the criminals, so it ends up being the criminals have them, the peaceful people don't. So it's that kind of upside-down thinking. So then as early as 1921, Jews began to organize a militia to protect their interests. British couldn't do it. At times, and didn't want to, British saw these as vigilantes, restricted their peacekeeping, and even arrested their leaders. Well, not much different than the wild American West, where the local marshal could not keep the peace in the open range. It was acceptable to allow the ranchers and farmers to arm themselves to protect their properties. In the land, capital L, the sheriff took the guns away from the settlers and allowed the marauders who perpetrated violence to keep their weapons, killing the settlers. Then we wonder, why is there no peace? Another irony, the Jews have been criticized for not putting up a defense during the Holocaust. Why didn't they fight? Yet when they do defend God-given, their God-given interest, they're criticized for overreaction. Well, the British miscalculation. If the British authorities, which will later be Attlee and Bevin, would have been students of the Bible, they would have been informed, Lloyd, about their false fears, rather than believe in the propaganda of the Arabs. See, the Arabs talk a big talk, and you believe the propaganda, and you start reacting to the propaganda, probably going to change what you do. They should have read the Bible, not listened to the propaganda. I wrote this before I watched this, but last night I watched again a couple of movies on the Iraq War in 1991. What a pushover. I mean, but if you remember before the war, you know, what do I say here? The Arabs threatened to wash the sand with American blood. I mean, it was graphic. I mean, it was, you're just afraid to turn on the TV because it was going to come out and get you. So they have that bluster. So the reality was in that 1991 war, so overwhelming in the end that we felt sorry for the defeated soldiers in the face of the American high-tech technology weaponry. Well, what was there in the Bible that would help them? Well, in Genesis 16, 11, or 12, particularly 12, it says about Ishmael's sons. God talks to the mother here. Behold, you're with child, and you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. And he will be a wild donkey of a man, whatever that means. But the point we want to see here is his hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand will be against him, which means to say that he can't get along with his brothers. Well, then I guess maybe we don't need to worry about this great international Arab uprising, that they're all going to get together. It's not going to happen. And we have seen that again and again. So they should have read their Bibles rather than listen to the propaganda. So what did the British err in? Well, first of all, they believed the propaganda of the Arab bluster, thus they failed in their judgment regarding the unity and the ability of the Arabs to mount a unified resistance. They thought they were going to just swamp the Jews over. And the Bible says that disunity is a characteristic of the descendants of Ishmael. And see that again. Hamas, what's his name? Habas, the guy that's the head of Hamas. Said that he really worries about the time when Israel won't be around because the Arabs will fight each other. And he can't control them. So in some sense, they're easier controlled if they got a common enemy in Israel because then they don't fight each other. Makes sense. It's a biblical point. The second error of the British was that Arab ability to control the oil market. They feared that the Arabs would starve the West of its oil. You hear that all the time. In fact, you still hear it today, even at $1. I heard this gas in Kansas is less than $1. So they think that somehow the world's beholden to them because of they have oil. Well, the counter to this is that the Saudis would have to give up their wealth for a war with the British and the U.S., and they would lose their market. 90% of the oil went to the United States. Maybe for a couple of weeks they might do that, but they're not that, whatever. Okay, we get back to this issue of hostage taking, which is really what's going on in the Middle East during these days. Hostage taking or blackmailing, either one, never is becoming a nation. And this weakness caused Britain to act in weak ways that had a deleterious effect on Zionism. A lesson learned by the U.S. dating back to the early 1800s, as some of you read about the Barbary Wars in Power, Faith, and Fantasy. There we go. Power, Faith, and Fantasy. Great book. Learned a lesson in the U.S. dating back to the early 1800s and the Barbary Wars, which are the Muslim Wars, Arab Wars in Northern Africa. In the Mediterranean Sea, the United States stopped paying ransom, millions and millions and millions of dollars of ransom, just to get these boats into the Mediterranean Sea. They finally said, no, we're not going to do that. And they went on shore and chased some of these Arabs down, and that was the end of it. They never challenged them again. So we stopped paying ransom to the Barbary pirates, and they ceased to give them their hostage taking. They ceased their taking hostages and their blackmail. Since then, the policy of the United States has always been not to negotiate with terrorists, although sometimes you think they're leaning in that direction. It's not a good idea. The British gave up the sovereignty, when you do that, of their nation, because now somebody else controls them, when they began to buy favor from the Arab, which is a form of blackmail. So this hostage appeasement is essential to understand the events of the violence in the land. Once you start appeasing somebody, you end up having this violence. Once hostage taking begins, the pressure to do the wrong thing increases with every concession. You know how I've never been blackmailed, but if you once start, there's no end to it. Oh, this will be the last one. No more. But it never is the last one. So we have these three sections in this period of time. The first one is from 1920 to 1939. It's under the British authority that 75% of the land is given to the Arabs. Land for the Jews, 75% is given to the Arabs. And at the end of that, we have peace, right? No. So there's no land for peace. No peace is achieved by this injustice. Let's try something else. Then 39 to 48, which is the period we're going to look at today, phasing out of the Jewish promises. In other words, take them totally out of the promise. They took out most of the land. Now we're going to take them totally out. Violence, then, is nearly out of control. The benefactors of the Balfour are now the enemy. Not the benefactors. They're now the enemy in terms of the British. British does not vote for the partition in 1947. And I'd say a full betrayal. They abstain. They abstain from the UN vote. So from 1948 to today, since the independence of Israel, the state of war continues. Well, under British authority, let's go through the same thing that was an outline. Briefly, the Arabs holding the British hostages characterizes this period. It is not a wholesale abandonment of the Jews, but a favoring of the Arabs at the expense of the Jews. Immigration is limited for the Jews, but immigration is unrestricted for the Arabs. They never encountered them. You're an Arab? Come on in. You're a Jew? Can't get in. I mean, it just seems so opposite from what the mandate was to do. The Arabs have the arms. The Jews are disarmed. It's illegal to have these guns, whatever they used. Violence from the Jew is largely aimed at reprisals against the Arab aggression. But the British are not targeted yet. So they're sort of keeping their powder cool, dry, and not doing anything to the British yet. The Jewish hope is that things will get better and your homeland will come in time. I mean, they're patient. They really are. So the next phase, this is a very painful part of Zionism, I said when I started my lesson. The white paper is the turning point in official British policy. The Jews, already fearing an abandonment by the British, now have policy making it official. It is difficult to be objective in making observations about Jewish violent reactions to this new reality. That's what I said before. I don't know what to do with this. So we just present it as it is. The white paper did not foster uniform reaction from all the Jews either. Some were impatient and aggressively defended their homeland, abandoning any help from the outside. They were obligated to fend for themselves. So you have different, aggressive ones. Some are, well, let's just wait a little longer. Others say, no, we got to do something right now because it's over. So we had the different groups formed. Now, this reconquest, I call it the reconquest of the land. We had it the first under Joshua, remember? Was there violence there? I can't quite remember. Under Joshua? Yes, there was. In fact, not this kind of violence at all. In fact, the Jews are not instructed here at all to kill the people that live in the land. And they never did, unless they were attacked and as a matter of defense. So we must avoid two extremes. One is that the Jews can do no wrong. People tell me that. Well, you think Jews do no wrong? I said, no, I don't say that. On the other hand, all that the violence the Jews do is not wrong. Now, you decide which is which. So our assessment is that land belongs to God, agreed, who has given it to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, agreed, since 586 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar's day. The Jews have suffered under the hands of the Gentiles, but now, leading up to 1948, how many years that is? Almost 2,500 years. A national restoration is in progress. The key to any nation to survive is a secure land or secure borders. And we argue about that in our country. No one knows for sure if that's true. It is true. And Jews knew it. As in the original conquest under Joshua, violence will characterize this reconquest because the foes of darkness will see to it. Remember, they're the perpetrators of it. Why do we get, the good guys always get blamed for violence when the other ones actually do it? So the question is, could violence have been avoided in the reoccupation of the land? I say yes, or at least a lot less. Who knows if it could be totally eliminated. The answer is yes, at least much less than what actually occurred in the 1920s to 1948. All that is necessary for violence to be abrogated would be for the British, this is pretty simple, folks, even a grade school child can get this, for the British not to favor the international Arabs. Don't worry about what they're saying, especially those in Iraq and Saudi Arabia, the Northern Africa, Egypt. Why are you listening to those guys? Remember, the early Arab leaders, Faisal and Ibn Saud, were favorable to even welcoming the Jews into the land. They even had dinner together. Saw them. If the British would have allowed the Jews to arm themselves, a small matter, the British could have kept the peace with a minimum military presence, and the Jews would easily have transitioned into a Jewish state in a matter of years, maybe 10 years, I could say even less, for sure by 1939. There would have been no Arab displacement against their will. The land purchases were a legitimate and fair commercial practice when it went on. All right. So that they could have had peace, but they decided not to because they wanted to favor the Arabs. Now you have trouble. So peace is through strength. When the British confiscated the arms from the Jews were exposed to Arab violence, whereas the Jews were illegally arming themselves out of necessity, then became the enemy of the British state. The opposite intention was of the British mandate. Peace is possible only if the law-abiding have weapons. Second Amendment in our Constitution. In broad terms, Zionism has just reasons, fair reasons, to act in violence when the British fail to enforce the mandate. I'm not sure that always works in every country, but I mean, you know, like you can't have the citizens do that, but in a country, but this is a fledgling country trying to be established, and I think that's it. I think there's a possible that's supportable. All right. Now, on the right here, we have this brown area was the original British mandate territory for the Jews. And by the time we get to 1937, this is called the Peel Commission, which we've not talked much about that. But they suggest a small sliver of land, this yellow ochre piece for Israel. Can you imagine this little sliver along the land, right along the coast here, about a pencil width thick is where the Jews can live. But for the Arabs, that's too much. You see, there's no hope here. There's just no hope here. All right, so this is what was suggested. Well, it was unworkable because it becomes unworkable territory with unworkable borders. So the transition to secure borders. However, we are not in any position to pass judgment on the acts of the Jews, for it was left to them to accomplish what the British failed to provide. I can't judge that. I don't know how to judge that. The choice was to survive at all costs, or to be annihilated in that generation. Remember, they just came out of the Holocaust. They had no place to go, and they were put back in the concentration camps after the war, and no place to go. It's just a matter of common sense that they're dying off. They're going to die off. They have no place to go. So it's my little illustration about the lioness and her cubs is a good example here. They're in a corner. They've been pushed into a corner, so I can't be critical of what they're doing. So at the end of this mandate period, sort of before the white papers issued, we have the Arab revolt. It lasted 3 years. It was very violent. It cost a lot of British lives, a lot of Arab lives. You know, it's something that you don't really want to have happen in your country. So despite the intervention of 50,000 British troops and 15,000 Haganah, that's the Jewish military, informal at this point, the uprising continued for 3 years. By the time it concluded in September 1939, more than 5,000 and over 300 Jews and 262 Britons had been killed. That's quite a few, but you see the Arabs really took the biggest heat. And at least 15,000 Arabs were wounded, and saying about how many the Jews were, but I suppose a similar amount, proportionally. So we have then the Haganah, the Ergun, and the Stern Defensive Organizations. These are the three groups. The Haganah is the one we probably know most because it's the largest and probably the most measured of their militia groups. The Ergun and the Stern ones were much more militant, and they were more in your face. We'll talk about it here in a minute. So this is a good place to talk about the Jewish defenses. Now, so I'll talk about the violence in the lesson today is heartrending. So a good place to start, talk about the Jewish defense organizations today. Today they're called the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces. The Haganah, the Palmach, and the Ergun Stern Lehi, or however you say it. The sides are given at 21,000, 3,000, 4,000, and 500. So they're not, you know, Stern Lee is very small, but they're very militant too. You know, you can do a lot with a bomb. So the Haganah was really the first security force used in the defense of the Israel in 1921 in the riots in Jaffa and Israel, or in Jerusalem. They assisted the British, and as soon as they saw they were successful, they told them don't do it anymore and to put them in jail. The Ergun in 4000 was organized as a more militant, less patient member of the Jewish community who were not content to wait for the Haganah and its more measured responses. So the Stern Lehi, that's the same group, they, one died and just took off another name. In 1940, they felt they needed to drive the British out of the mandated territories. They saw them as an obstacle, and so they had only one idea about them, drive them out by acts of terror, send them home. So we have then these headline news things. From 1940, there were many terrorist acts directed at the British diplomats. Now we're looking a little toward the British here. Were carried out by the vigilante organizations after a lull in British attacks during World War II. They sort of took the side of, I'll say this in a minute here, but first of all, some of these extreme groups took the side of the Germans, yes, because the Germans were against Britain. But then when they saw what the Germans were doing to their people, they had to change sides, so they backed off until the war was over, then they went after Britain again. So that's what I mean, a little lull. So we have these terrorist attacks. We get a picture. They attacked the railroads. They attacked the office buildings. They attacked, you know, not civilians as such, but anything to stop the British from being able to transport military equipment. So 1940 on, the British now take on the character of the enemy in the eyes of the Jew. The Ergun split. The Lehi and the Stern made overtures for an alliance with Germany. I just mentioned this to you in the early part of World War II. This was in reaction to the perceived traitor nation of Britain, whose overthrow fit the plans of the Jewish militants, a group. Britain was more of an enemy than Nazi Germany was for a while, but Stern died and so forth. This became unpopular, so they went back, and obviously they didn't support Nazis very long because they found out what they're doing to their own people. Then as the Nazi threat was real, the Jews backed the British against the Germans, even having 5,000-member brigade fighting the Germans in Italy. So it's really kind of really messy and confusing at what time we're talking about. I kind of jump around and kind of keep the times up for you there. February 1944, the Ergun, now led by Menachem Begin, remember him, ended the wartime truce and declared an uprising. Begin believed that the only way to save European Jews was to compel the British to leave Palestine as fast as possible and open the country to unrestricted Jewish immigration, which was the issue. I said up there, limit immigration. That's the problem. We can't get people in here. So we got to get rid of those that stop this immigration. In the heart of Jerusalem, killing civilians and Jews alike was the high point of Jewish aggression against the British. From the British point of view, the burden of Jerusalem had a stranglehold on their image and a drain on sacred scarce resources. But it had a high cost of human life with nothing to show for it. That's how the British saw it. So the King David Hotel was bombed in 1946, and they gave a warning. It was ignored by Menachem Begin gave the warning. He quotes that they told him to get out of the building, and they said, an official supposedly said, that we don't take orders from the Jews, let everybody in it. And the result, 91 died, 45 injured, and of those, 15 were Jews. I guess they mean business. Back in 45, a little bit later, in October, the Haganah fighters raid the Atlit detainee camp, which is in Israel. It's still there. You can go look at it. I've been by it, but I've never, you know, don't have time to go to everything. Which was used by the British to hold thousands of illegal Jewish immigrants from Europe. So they broke in and freed 108 inmates. So these are things that these offshoot groups did. Oh, this was the Haganah. The raid was planned by Yitzhak Rabin, commanded by Nathan Sarig, I don't know who he is, and executed by Palmach, another group. Well, 45 Israel's military attacks. November 1, night of the trains. The Haganah fighters sabotaged railroads used by the British, sank three British guard boats. At the same time, the Irgun-led unit by Eitan Levni, don't know him either, raided a train station in Lod, which is where the airport is in Tel Aviv, destroyed a number of buildings and three train engines, one Irgun fighter, two British soldiers, and four Arabs were killed. And you just go on the list, always a lot of killing. December 27, Irgun fighters raided and bombed the British intelligence office in Jerusalem, killing seven British policemen. Two Irgun fighters were also killed. Irgun also attacked the British army camp in northern Tel Aviv. In the exchange of fire, a British soldier and Irgun fighter were killed. Five Irgun fighters were injured. We have Menachem Begin there on the middle with the soldier's uniform. And then we have the night of the bridges. I got so many pictures. And when you get done with this, I'm going to have to bring you some of my pictures. I got to show you some of the stuff. I think it was our last trip. If you go on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, and you go to the south end of Galilee, east side, south end, there's a road that goes down, cleared down to the Sea of Galilee, which is 600 feet below sea level. So you go above sea level to below sea level. So this road is pretty steep and a lot of hairpin turns. And off to the left, if you're going back to the north, turning back to the north, the Yarmouk River is over here. And last night I was looking through my files, and I got one is in the video, and our guide is talking about this bridge was bombed. Well, that's what we're seeing here. They bombed, I think, eight bridges. What did I see here? Eight bridges. June 17, 1946, the aim was to destroy eight bridges linking Mandatory Palestine to the neighboring countries of Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, in order to suspend the transportation routes used by the British Army. In fact, that thing looks there pretty much like you see it today. I don't know whether they're leaving it as a memorial, but it was never rebuilt. That's another picture of it, which in this picture still has the middle span down the bottom of the river. Maybe they took it out later on. Maybe they need the steel or something. Anyway, that's the same bridge on the Yarmouk River at the north end of the Jordan River, if you know how this all lays out. If you don't, get your map out. All right. Attacks on the additional three bridges had been considered but were not executed. Only one operation failed. That one, 14 were killed and so forth. The other operation is successful without injuries. So they did a lot of damage that one night. Now, 100,000 people, 100,000, attempted illegally to enter Palestine. Only a few thousand actually made it. 100,000 attempted illegally to enter Palestine during this period. 142 voyages by 120 ships. Over half were stopped by British patrols. The Royal Naval had eight ships on station in Palestine, and additional ships were tasked with tracking suspicious vessels heading for Palestine. Most of the intercepted immigrants were sent to internment camps in Cyprus, the island. Some were sent to the Atli detention, which you're looking at, camp in Palestine. Another place I don't recognize. The British had as many as 50,000 in these camps at one time. In the process, 1,600 of them drowned at sea in some kind of operation. Only a few thousand actually entered Palestine. Now, this is the British stopping Israel's from coming into Israelites coming from land. Remember, they weren't stopping the Arabs, but they were just stopping the Jews. So we know about the ship Exodus. The movie is not exactly accurate that you see with, Newman, right? Paul Newman? Yeah. The ending isn't the way it ended up being because they end up going back to Germany in the real life. So in Exodus, July 18, 1947, the passengers refused to disembark, spent weeks in difficult conditions on the ship. It was a ship that carried Jewish immigrants from France to Britain to Mandatory Palestine. Most of the immigrants were Holocaust survivors and had no legal immigration certificates for Palestine. The ship was taken to Germany, where the passengers were forcibly removed at Hamburg and returned to displaced person camps. The event became a major media event influencing UN deliberations. Now, this is before the vote. So it's one of these kind of things that God probably allowed to do to put the pressure on the Gentiles to do something. So it damaged British international image and prestige, exasperating the already poor relationship between Britain and the Jews. So that later on that year, 1947, the UN voted to partition the land and end the British mandate in May then, in 48. Some 20,000 Jews were still interned at Cyprus camps. This is the end of things here. When the mandate was dissolved, partition was enacted, and the independent Jewish state of Israel was established at midnight Palestine time, 1948, May 14, 1948. About 11,000 internees remained in the camps as of August 48. That's after they declared them as a nation. With the British being helpful here, they're releasing and transporting the internees to Haifa at the rate of 1,500 a month. Israel began the final evacuation of the camps in December 1948 with the last 10,000 Jewish internees in Cyprus, mainly men in military age, evacuated to Israel during January 49. So now finally, the displaced persons have been cared for. But when this is going on, massacres are still occurring. There is one horrible one on Mount Scopus, the massacre by Arab Palestinians of some 80 passengers and defenders of a convoy to Hadassah Hospital on Mount Scopus in Jerusalem, April 13, 1948. That when you go by that spot, they still tell us this is where that massacre occurred. The victims were mostly doctors, nurses, and other staff. The massacre had been planned long in advance, but was spun as a reprisal for the raid of Deir Yassin by the Ergun and the Lehi, which there was a massacre, which I don't want to get into, but there was an event. Now they are retaliating, and they killed these, they killed doctors and nurses. I mean, those are the people that keep you alive. I mean, no heart, huh? The British authorities now, on top of all that, deliberately refrained from stopping the massacre. The British soldiers collaborated in it. Unlike the Deir Yassin raid, this massacre was planned in advance, a deliberate crime against medical personnel and civilians. The British Army dismissed the ambush as retaliation for the Ergun attack on the Arab village of Deir Yassin. Official Arab response was that they had heard that the Jewish gangs were assembled near the Hadassah Hospital, you know, so they had an excuse to do this. Graves, the British appointee, chairman of the Jerusalem Municipal Commission, said the Arabs did not realize that killing of doctors and nurses and university teachers was a dastardly outrage. Really? That's an excuse. Well, the IDF, we're talking about in May now, a little bit after the Independence Day. Defense Minister David Ben-Gurion, after Independence Day, ordered the splinter defense forces join. They were at odds, holding to various levels of aggression. The conflict nearly erupted when Ergun tried to bring the Altalena, a ship loaded with arms. Ergun leader Begin had to decide to hand over the arms to the now unified IDF or have his ship bombed. He resisted, and they bombed his ship. This is Jew-on-Jew stuff here now. You know, they got to be together on this. Now back up, or I should say down the road here, 48, back up a little bit. On Valentine's Day, 1947, the British announced that they were vacating the mandate responsibilities and refer the question of the Jews and the Arab statehood to the United Nations. In a vote on partition, or on the Resolution 181, was before the UN for Wednesday before Thanksgiving Day, but it was delayed until Monday, November 29, after the long Thanksgiving weekend.
You all know how to vote. Those who are in favor will say yes, those who are against will say no. And the abstainers, always, they know what to say.
We will start it now.
Afghanistan, now. Argentina, Argentina, abstention. Australia, yes. Belgium, yes. Bolivia, yes. Brazil, yes. Belarus, yes. Egypt, no. El Salvador,
abstain.
Abstention. Ethiopia, abstain. France, yes. Greece? No. Guatemala? Yes. Haiti? Yes. Honduras? Abstain. Iran? No. Iraq? No. Lebanon? No. Soviet Union? Yes. United Kingdom? Abstain. The United States?
Yes.
Yes.
All right, there you heard it. 33 votes, 18 against, and some abstentions. And the remarkable thing of the whole thing is that England abstained. All right. Yeah, they were still smoking in those days. Make sure I'm going the right way here. All right. So the British had announced the withdrawal at the end of the mandate, which would end at the end of the day, May 14, 1948. In the intervening period, this 5.5 months, violence continued on both sides, warring and preparing for bigger war. Surprisingly, there was no provision after May 14, midnight, for anyone to assume the peacekeeping or administrative responsibility for May 15 and after. I'm amazed at that. The UN had not made any provision to act as custodian. No nation had volunteered their oversight. It was a simple dead end or a cul-de-sac. Since the UN voted to partition the land into two states, the assumption must have been that the two states would emerge as the British leave, bringing continuity and stability to the region. While the Jews were making provision for statehood, actually from 1921, they established the Haganah, they had education, they had services, they had appointed leaders. All were ready by midnight of May 14 to declare themselves, as Israel, a state. The Arabs had made no such preparation, were unprepared to act or declare themselves a state. The UN treated the Arabs with the same consideration, given the Jews yet an Arab state did not emerge. So we have the headlines about the Israel being born, and we read in the Bible, born in a day, just moving on. Whereas Israel emerged ready to assume the duties of state, had a provisional leader and government in place, and was straightaway recognized by the United States and Russia and others in the days ahead, the reaction of the Arab in the land and from the international Arab community beyond the land was predictable. As there was no interest in statehood, there was an animus towards the Jews and their statehood status. So the hostility of the Arabs had been somewhat controlled by the Arab forces before, but now they were able to launch a full-scale war against Jewish nation. So this was a fast-moving war, also called the War of Independence, and if you are there on the Day of Independence, you'll find out the Arab calls it the Nakba, the Day of Disgrace. So we have the war they go to war right away in May of 15, and by June 11 there is the first truce. So the war lasted 27 days. Now there's two truces here. There's one then, and there's one in July, lasts until October. And the reason the truces lived was because the Arabs asked for them. And if the Arab wouldn't have asked for them, the Jews would have kept on going, and they would have taken more land. I don't know where they could have. I don't know if they would have been stopped. Now, admittedly, the first 10 days of the war, it didn't look good for Israel. They actually lost the Temple Mount, the area that they hold sacred, and they didn't have it back again then until 1967. So then we get to around at the fall of 1948. The war is really over. It's in an armistice state, but it really doesn't get declared an armistice until February or June 1949. And then Israel makes these armistice agreements with each of the nations. It's not one with the whole group because it's Egypt and Lebanon and Jordan, Saudis and Iraq. They're all separately dealt with. So that's why we don't have just one date. They have different dates. So the attack on that day was multifaceted. You see them stop over here, and you see the blue areas is actually the area that the Jews were defending and were moving the line into the Arabs' territory May 15, 1948, six Arab armies, those of Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq, invaded Israel. They advanced rapidly, threatening to destroy the one-day-old state and drive its citizens to the sea. The Israelis existed, and after 10 days were able to counterattack. A truce was signed on June 11, 1948. Israel gained 50% more territory than the partition. The war created 700,000 refugees, and they either went to the West Bank or went to Jordan. But the Jews lost control of the holy site, the Temple Mount, until 1967. But look at the number of refugees that have been generated here. Well, Jewish foresight, realizing the need for more advanced and numerous weapons for the planned operation, the Jewish agency began to clandestinely purchase weapons on the international market. It's kind of something you don't know a lot about. A vast majority of these were supplied to them by Czechoslovakia, the communist regime under which had seized power in 1948 in the February coup, and included a large number of tanks, fighter aircraft, assorted light and heavy weapons. So they got 25 German-like, kind of like Messerschmitts, kind of like fighters, that apparently the place where the engines were kept blew up. I think it was after the war, so they didn't have these nice Mercedes engines to put in there, so they'd have put these Junker Jumos, I don't know what they are, Junko is the name of the thing, these bomber engines and this fighter aircraft that made the airplane almost impossible to fly, especially to land and take off, because there's so much torque. You know, the airplane's light, the motor, the big propeller, you know, it's difficult. Then we got some super marine Spitfires, English type. And so these all come from Czechoslovakia, and they were loaded up in planes, taken apart, stuck into these transports, and flown over, you know, secretly over these lands, and land them in Tel Aviv, put them back together. And some of these fighters, by the way, get put into the air without ever being flown, and put right into combat. And if you're interested in this, look for the movie Up Beyond, Above and Beyond. Above and Beyond, great. If you have Amazon Prime, it's free. I mean, I've watched it twice. It's produced by Spielberg, so it's very well done. And it's going to talk about stuff that I'm going to talk about here, about these airplanes, how they did it, and so forth.
Schwimmer had to figure out a way to get the planes out of the U.S. He couldn't take them to Palestine because the British were still there and on high alert for arms smugglers. But you couldn't leave them in the U.S., because of the arms embargo. So they would have to hopscotch around the globe to get as close to Palestine as possible. This idea was hatched to turn these Jewish planes into the nucleus of a fake airline. There was a former Air Force major who was friends with the nephew of the Panamanian president.
So we were ready to get into Panama, which is a phony.
Have these planes lining up on the taxiway to take off, and they're very well aware that this embargo is taking effect. And you have these treasury agents, the team members they were called in the day, show up, and there's a confrontation with some of the pilots who are getting ready to take off.
But these are foreign registered aircraft. No, they're not. They're U.S. But he says, wait a minute. Goes in the hangar, comes out with a mechanic with a can of blue paint. The mechanic gets up on one of the sides of the Z-46s and he prints LATSA, L-A-T-S-A, Linear City of Panama, floppy letters all bleeding down. Swifty says to the guy, okay, now they're foreign registered. The guy says, well, I still want to let you go. And he said to the teammate, you want to stop us? Shoot us down.
Now, one thing I want to mention I haven't mentioned is in 1948, before the independence, Golda Meir was sent, she volunteered, to go to America to raise money for what was coming, this war was coming. She was going to go and maybe raise, I think she was going to raise like $25 million. I'm wondering, where does all this money come from to buy these planes? They only cost, I say here, $5,000 for a plane, but still, you buy those and all the gas that you got to put into them and fly them all these places. Well, she came over and raised $50 million. From the Jewish sympathizers here in the States. All right, so we're going to talk about this Schwimmer. Equal fascinating is the Schwimmer, a TWA employee who bought surplus C-46s for $5,000. He eventually smuggled that and about 30 other aircraft to Israel when the nation was under an embargo that prevented it from purchasing weapons. Remember, there was one, and Truman didn't lift it. Convicted of violating the U.S. Neutrality Act, Schwimmer lost his U.S. citizenship and remained in Israel. Now get this, President Clinton in 2001 pardoned him. That's how long this has been going on. Despite some setbacks during the early months of the war, initial Arab advantage in the possession of advanced weapons, the smaller Jewish community managed to mobilize its manpower and eventually redressed the armament imbalance. This ultimately enabled it to employ field forces superior to those that the Arabs were able to muster. Both sides were novices in warfare, committed many blunders leading to needless casualties. Yet it seemed that the Arabs erred more and were less animated in the struggle, which I think is the key point, less animated in the struggle, in comparison with the Israelis who felt that they were fighting with their backs to the wall and they were fighting for their very life. So a conference in Switzerland didn't go anywhere. I'm just skipping that because of time. So I give you a couple more things here. This comes out of that paper. If that's on my Facebook. He writes, some of this is what he writes. Today's media never attempt, and he says not even for the History Channel, to explain how it was Soviet and East Bloc aid and not American support that was the crucial factor which brought both essential weapons and manpower to the beleaguered newborn Israeli state in 1948 and enabled it to turn the tide of battle and justifiably hand the Palestinian Arabs and their allies their Nakba, remember that word, Soviet hopes that they might eventually pressure the new and profoundly democratic Israel state to side with them in the Cold War was hopelessly naive. Now, the Arabs cannot admit the truth of Soviet aid to Israel as it would rob them of their psychological advantage, that they are victims who have the right to continually browbeat the Western and especially American public opinion as responsible for this catastrophe. Without changing its official anti-Zionist stance from late 1944 until 1948, those 4 years, Joseph Stalin had adopted a de facto a recognition of Israel as a fact with borders. Joseph Stalin had adopted a de facto pro-Zionist foreign policy, apparently believing that the new country would be socialist and would speed the decline of British influence in the Middle East. And that is why Soviet Union is in the Middle East. They want to get rid of the British, even to the point of recognizing Israel. Now, to facilitate this, Stalin released 200,000 Jews to Europe, expecting that they would end up as a further embarrassment to the British, who they're going to go to camps, right? And they would eventually go to Palestine. Fine, that's not a problem. But he wanted to embarrass the British. These were essential when thinking about the loss of 750,000 Arabs who fled their home, expect to return, and claim their property. So we have the Arabs leave, and Stalin releases 200,000 of the Jews from Russia. They're going to end up in Palestine. They're going to go through these camps. So it's almost like that was perfect. You know, get rid of the people who live there on their own and bring in the people you need. And here's Stalin doing this. Now, the Arabs make a complaint here. They think their rules of war are different. So I say this. The rules of war, that the defeated aggressor loses all rights to territories abandoned. They left, these 450,000. If the tradition amongst the Arab is different, and they say it is, Israel abides by the rules of engagement of the conquering West. Therefore, it is not obligated to return abandoned private property, even though they say they have to. Okay, even with Czech weapons and Soviet aid, Israel would undoubtedly have been unable to halt the Arab invasion without a massive inflow of manpower. That's where the 200,000 come from. The United States, Canada, Europe provide no more than 3,000 volunteers, many of them combat-hardened veterans from both the European and Pacific theaters of war, plus a few hundred idealistic youngsters, green behind the ears, from the Zionist movement with no combat experience or training. Their numbers were a drop in the bucket compared to the 200,000 Jewish immigrants from the Soviet Union that dominated the countries of Eastern Europe, notably Poland, Bulgaria. 95% of the entire Jewish community came. Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, former Baltic states, and even the Soviet Union, who immigrated to Israel, arriving in time to reach the front lines to replenish the depleted ranks of civilian manpower. Without both the arms and manpower sent from the Soviet camp to aid the nascent Israeli state, they would have been crushed. So just point out here the shift in the numbers here. These are Arab numbers. They go from 1.2 million to less than 200,000. Now, these are Jewish numbers. They count a little better than the Arabs do. And then here we go from 700,000 up to another 500,000 up to over 1 million. So they went down here and they went up here. So over here, these are percentage of the Jews in the land. We go from 30% to 80%, and it continues to be 80% down here to 70%. All right, so that's the point of all that. A lot of people came and they helped. We're almost done. Between 1948 and 1951, more than 300,000 Jews from Eastern Europe went to Israel, half of the total influx of migration during that time. Moscow also supported Israel in another aspect of the democratic battle, the homogenization of its population, which led to the departure mainly through expulsion. I don't understand that sentence. I'm trying to who's being expelled here, because the Arabs didn't get expelled. They walked out. But anyway, 700,000 of them left. I don't know why he used that word. The USSR absolved Israel of responsibility and blamed the British. In 1948, the Soviet Union voted against UN Resolution 194 on the possible return of Palestinian refugees. Russia said no. And we're the ones get blamed for it. 3 days after Israel declared independence, the Soviet Union legally recognized it de jure, which is the better one. In addition, the USSR allowed Czechoslovakia to continue to supply arms to the Jewish forces during the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, even though the conflict took place after the Soviets supported Czechoslovakia coup d'etat in 1948. One of those kind of things, how could that be? At the time, the United States maintained an arms embargo on both sides of the conflict. All right. So by the end of 1957, 10 years later, the USSR switched sides, I would say again, in the Arab-Israeli conflict and throughout the course of the Cold War, unequivocally supported the various Arab regimes against Israel. See, we have this window of time that's absolutely remarkable. The official position of the Soviet Union and its satellite states and agencies was that Zionism was a tool used by the Jews and Americans for racist imperialism. Now, some comments. I got to say this with all my heart. The period we just covered is simply mind-boggling in its complexity. I sat there, my mind was so loaded up today, so hot, because I was trying to think this thing through. Very, very complex. I probably missed some important points. I hope not. So we have a couple of observations. One, that the United States, a Christian nation, takes more credit for the establishment of Israel than probably is due. I'm not saying they didn't have a role. But we want to make it us did everything. As Christians, we want our country to be on the right side of history, that is to support the Jewish nationalism. In pursuit of that goal, it is easy to overstate our importance and fail to see or underestimate or the importance of others, even those that are hostile to Israel today, like Russia. So why do we want to give them any credit? So we asked the question, was the United States an unqualified supporter of Zionism? And I said, hardly not. You know, Truman did his good thing, but there was a lot of opposition in the State Department and the military. Israel did not get any arms from the United States until John F. Kennedy, 1962. Truman lent money to Israel, that's true. And after the 1973 war, Yom Kippur, Israel did receive military aid from the United States. But we're down the road quite a ways. And Israel does say the biggest benefactor as of now is the United States. They've given them the most money now. Truman never lifted the arms embargo, and he revoked the citizenship of Schirmer, who smuggled the aircraft to Israel. The rank of the United States president favorable to Israel, this is maybe interesting to you, by the Jewish press gives them in this order. These are the ones that are most favorable to Israel gets first. Nixon. Bush, the younger, Johnson, Reagan, Truman, Clinton, Kennedy, Ford, Bush, the older, Obama, Eisenhower, and last and least, Carter. I never would have guessed that. So that's how they look at it. So a final thought. While we have spent a lot of time looking at the history of Zionism as Israel is returning to the land, remember that if we read our Bibles for information about the first national encounter with the land, we would have to read all of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Now, wouldn't it be helpful if the Lord would have reduced my lesson to text so I didn't have to wonder what happened and guess? But he didn't do that. We have no inspired writing about that kind of current history. So it would be helpful if the Lord would have reduced this important information to inspired writing as he did in these books. But since he did not do that, we are forced to study all of it, trying to make sense of the many details. So I would just say thanks for your patience. Lord, thank you for the evening. Again, for the reminder that you are bringing back your people into the land. You did it the first time with great splendor and accomplishment. We think about the miracles, delivering Israel out of Egypt, and the great miracles of the signs that Moses performed, the crossing of the Dead Sea, the crossing of the Jordan River, the destruction of Jericho, and so forth. Lord, all these things are fresh in our mind, and now we look at you bringing them back into the land without the text for us to read, but we can read the history and sort out what actually is happening. Thank you, Lord, that we have the assurance that you are coming back again, and the nation back in the land is an evidence of the times we're living in, the lateness of the hour. So may we be patient as we wait and occupy until you come. Thank you, Lord, for the word. Thank you, Lord, for this local church that teaches the word in these lessons so that we might learn more about you. And in part of that, we need to understand about history. And Lord, thank you for the opportunity we have to do that in this class. Keep us safe as we go home to our families and bring us back again next week, and pray it all in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you.